You're listening to episode 5 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia.
David, I saw on our Facebook page that we had a comment from Xavier Marshall. And he said, "Keep it up. I love the show. I'll get around to sending feedback and pictures of my multi-copter builds." As we know from Airplane Geeks, we love photos from our listeners. And so I think I'd encourage everyone listening to, you know, send us their photos if you've got some of your copter or whatever it is you're building or doing with UAVs these days. Send them along to us.
Usually we throw them up on our cover page for when we post a new show notes, and we could also throw them around our Google Plus and our Facebook page and our Twitter account. So, yeah, we definitely like to see what our listeners are up to.
Very good. So, David, what are we going to talk about this episode?
Well, first we're going to talk about other people's property. Optionally piloted vehicles or optionally piloted helicopters. Then we're going to talk about a follow-on to last week where we talk about the fast response from the FAA on the drone request to fly California Air National Guard to fly a Predator up to help the rimfire. A forecast for the global UAV market, which supports our theory that this is going to be the fastest growing aviation portion of the industry in the world. Success tips for UAV suppliers and the development of water sampling UAVs or drones.
Our first story is Polish SW4 Solo to assist Royal Navy rotary wing study. So we have the SW4 Solo. This is a RUAS. We're getting into acronyms, David. Rotorcraft Unmanned Aerial System. And this is being introduced by PZL Swidnik and Augusta Westland. This is based on the PZL SW4 light single engine helicopter.
This is a trend all of a sudden. These small helicopters, training helicopters, the only one that hasn't joined the party yet, I think, is Robinson. So I think they're a little late on the ball. But converting these kind of helicopters over to either remotely piloted or optionally piloted. Optionally piloted is not something we've talked about in our shows yet, which means it's set up to do both. You could get a pilot in it, and the pilot could land the aircraft, get out of it, and somebody could take it off as a UAV, which is different. It's that hybrid area where the United States Army and the Royal Navy and stuff are looking at existing platforms and trying to convert them into UAVs.
Right. They're looking for multi-role capability, aren't they, David?
Multi-role and multi-pilot, whether you have a person in the copter or you have them on the ground in a ground station.
So this SW4, it carries up to 5 people. It's got a single turbine engine and 3 composite main blades. Maximum gross weight is around 4,000 pounds. And the engine is rated at 450 shaft horsepower for takeoff. So it's a pretty light helicopter. And they have a number of missions in mind for this craft, don't they?
Missions would include intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, cargo resupply like the Lockheed and Cayman K-MAX that they're using in Afghanistan, and transportation of personnel at sea. So I guess what you would say is for the Royal Navy, I'm sure that they would not be flying it remotely with passengers aboard, but they could be flying it remotely in for vertical replenishment or vert rep, or if they're going to fly it in a more hostile area for observation, they would fly it unmanned. That way you're not risking personnel and you can fly it in a hot zone.
And others are taking a look at optionally piloted helicopters as well. One of them notably is Sikorsky Aircraft. They have a research program which they call Matrix Technology. And what they're trying to do is develop some systems and especially the software for autonomous, optionally piloted, and piloted vertical takeoff and landing aircraft without being helicopters. Sikorsky is using an optionally piloted S-76, which of course is a very popular helicopter. They call this the Sikorsky Autonomous Research Aircraft, or SARA. And they're using that as a flying lab. But they do plan to demonstrate this in an operational fashion with an optionally piloted Black Hawk.
That way the Army could use it, could convert their existing Black Hawk fleet to be optional.
Right.
That I mean, if you're going to do sling loads or something like that, you might want to fly in a hot zone, you might want to fly the helicopter optionally. What's unique about all of these is it's not one or the other. You have to have both sets of controls combined into one vehicle. So you have to be able to turn off the remote control, per se, so you can fly it with the pilot, or vice versa, make sure that the pilot controls are turned off when you're flying it remotely. So that, there's got to be some challenges to having all of that blend together into one unit.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also see that Eurocopter, which is soon to be renamed Airbus Helicopter, they've conducted demonstration flights with an optionally piloted EC-145. And their press release from the past makes mention of the fact that they plan to look at OPV variants for pretty much the whole product line, it sounds like. So that would certainly bring a broad spectrum of optionally piloted helicopters to the market. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And you wonder if the optional part will actually be an option, or they're all going to come off the line set up to be both going forward in the future. We'll have to follow that portion of it, too.
That's right. All right, what's next, David?
Well, I guess we should talk follow on to our story about the Predator last week. And with the story, the FAA cuts red tape to let UAS work Yosemite Wildfire. Desperate to get a better view of the giant wildfire last month, a call for help from the incident commander went to the California governor's office, then to the Department of Defense, and to the FAA. The emergency certificate of authorization was issued within hours to the FAA, to the California Air National Guard, to fly their MQ-1 Predator over the Yosemite file. We got to give it credit. Neither a governor's office, a Department of Defense, or FAA are offices that you would regard as expedient when it comes to paperwork.
That's an understatement, I think.
It's like military intelligence. It's an oxymoron. But clearly, the FAA understood the severity of it, and the Department of Defense, and they got it together and put a coherent plan in, and the Predator was actually very significant in helping to work the fire.
That's right. I think that those who were trying to control this fire and contain it didn't have as much intelligence or as much observation about the fire, where it was and where how it was moving and all that sort of thing. And they really needed, I'll say, an eye in the sky. And the Predator turned out to be very handy for providing that kind of information to the crews. So that was great. There was another example of the FAA being super responsive to the quick need for an unmanned vehicle. And this was back last year in 2012. There was a situation in Nome, Alaska, where there was a ship bringing fuel to Nome. Nome was running out of fuel, like a number of towns, villages, cities in Alaska. They depend on these kinds of shipments to keep things going. And they were having trouble getting the ship to Nome. And what they needed was a UAV. They could go up there, take a look at the ice, and help direct the ship so that it could get as close as possible to the harbor. And in that case, the FAA also quickly granted an emergency COA, Certificate of Authorization. So that's good. We've got a track record going here, David, with the FAA being really responsive to these situations. So that's very encouraging.
Yeah, and the fact that they're thinking out of the box, the Predator with its infrared cameras was vitally important, and having the Nome, Alaska, where they were iced in early and they didn't get their last fuel shipment in, that was acting as a bit of a tracker or a sled dog, pulling the tanker in depending upon the thickness of the ice. So I think we got to give the FAA credit. They may be slow to move on some things, but when it counts, they seem to find a way to get it done.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that we're often singing the praises of the FAA, so it's nice to be able to do that.
And folks, we did say this was going to be a very different podcast than Airplane Geeks. So there's another example.
We have a forecast out of the global UAV market. This is a 10-year forecast, a 10-year look ahead from the Strategic Defense Intelligence Organization. The report is titled The Global UAV Market 2013 to 2023. Now, we haven't seen the report because it costs $4,800 to purchase this report. So we only have some limited information about the contents of it. But they have published the summary as well as the table of contents, which gives some clues as to what's in the report. One of the things that is mentioned is that the global UAV market is estimated to be, in U.S. dollars, $114.7 billion during the period of the survey. That's pretty healthy, David, $117 billion.
And it's not just North America. It's also there's 24 billion in Europe. The other really interesting aspect of it is the majority of it will be not in small drones, but what we call hail drones, which are high altitude, long endurance. So Predators and Reapers and some of the other atmospheric satellites we've talked about, that's where the money's going to be in. So if you have a hail drone, that this is the one you're going to be selling. But Max, maybe since you've been in the industries for a multitude of years, how do they formulate these kind of reports? I'm sure you've been part of them or used them in the past.
Well, there's certainly a lot of research that goes into it. Some of it is searching publicly available information, typically reports or statements from other companies. Some of it is based on data that comes from some of the major companies. So sometimes these research firms will go out and survey some companies and look to see what the consensus is amongst them. And then sort of the other component to generating a market forecast like this may be some mathematical models where you essentially make some assumptions about growth rates, market segments, market share, things like that, and actually generate a forecast. Now, it's interesting because here's a 10-year forecast. In 10 years from now, probably nobody is going to go back and pull out their $4,800 forecast from 2013 and see how accurate it was. But usually these things are kind of a pretty good indicator. One of the takeaways for me is that just looking through the table of contents, David, I mean, this thing seems to be pretty comprehensive in terms of looking at different regional growth rates, looking at different companies, looking at different segments of the market. And you can't even tell from the table of contents how long the report is, but it looks pretty extensive. So if I was in the business, if it was my livelihood to understand this market well, if I did that in a decent sized company, I think this would be one of those kind of things that you would want to go out and obtain. I think this has a lot of good information in it. At least it looks that way from what we can see.
So if anybody listens to the podcast from Strategic Defense Intelligence, we'll be happy to look forward a review copy of the report, and we'll be happy to discuss it with our listeners.
Yeah, not violating any copyright issues or agreements with the company. All right. We had an interesting story that comes from an agricultural perspective. This is called Managing the UAV Madness, Five Keys to Success. I think we can all imagine that agricultural applications for unmanned vehicles are probably a big opportunity area. I mean, with large agribusiness, I mean, you're talking about many, many acres of farmland. It could be some of it may be depending on what you're growing, whether it's crops or livestock. It could be difficult terrain, whatever. I can imagine it being a challenge for the farmers to manage, maintain, keep an eye on all of that. So UAVs seem to be a great opportunity for that business. So this article comes from Robert Blair, who's a wheat grower in Kendrick, Ohio. And he spoke at the InfoAg conference about unmanned aerial vehicles, and he had some advice. He had five keys to success, which are from an agricultural business, but when we get through them in the end, I think we're going to see that they are really kind of more broadly applicable. But anyway, his first tip, his first key is that those who seek to profit from a UAV agricultural business boom, they have to recognize the relationship culture of farmers. He said, if you treat them like customers, in sort of the negative sense, you won't succeed. But if you build the relationship with them, then you have a shot at it. That relationship is very important.
And I think that's a good point. I mean, you need to build a relationship, and especially implementation of technology. I mean, if we're talking agriculture, let's look at things like John Deere. Your local John Deere in the Midwest, your local John Deere store is not just a place to pick up parts for your tractor, but it's kind of a local social club. It's a network for, it's where farmers can swap stories or talk about. So UAV people need to start adapting to that kind of cultural model.
Very good. And the second item here, the second tip is, he says that you have to partner with agriculture and create kind of a two-way sharing of information. I think he's saying that farmers, those in the agricultural business, they know that business. They know it well. Producers of UAVs or those who would sell that service to this market, they know their stuff as well. And so you have to have this sort of partnership where both parties understand each other because we're starting from the beginning, right? That knowledge, that cross-industry knowledge doesn't really exist. So you have to make sure that there's a partnership.
Agreed. And definitely for the UAV market, giving the farmers what they want will open up even more opportunities for them. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we have the new product, so we need to listen closely to the people who are going to use the product. And you might be surprised. They might come up with a lot of uses up for it that we've never thought of.
Sure. The third key is, I like this one a lot. He says, use the farmer's vast knowledge. And it's kind of related to the one we just listened to. The quote from him, though, I think is brilliant. He said, just because you build it doesn't necessarily mean that they will come. And, you know, that you mentioned technology, David. I think that's oftentimes an approach that technology people will take, is they look at the technology. They're so enamored of the technology. They look at the technology and they say, here, you know, you must want this because it's such great technology and there's probably a lot of things you can do with it. And that's not a good way to develop a business.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like what I said to my sister-in-law when I got my first Keurig coffee maker. I looked at her and said, what the heck am I going to do with this? I've got a perfectly good coffee maker. And little did I know how much of an addiction that was going to become. But
you didn't know it at first.
But I was very I and my wife were very reluctant at first. So that's a good analogy for you need to present it in a more positive manner than just say, here, you absolutely need this, okay? Usually you have to answer the why.
And the why is part of the fourth key, actually. It says create products that farmers want, not what you think they need. And you need to quantify the value. He's thinking from a farmer standpoint, agriculture, where they have to be, I guess frugal is not really the right word, but very conscious of costs and where they spend their money. I mean, the returns are not great. If most farmers are not awash in a sea of cash. And so how they spend their money is something that they consider very carefully. And so you have to show and quantify what the value is of this device or this service that you're trying to sell.
Exactly. And you might need to start thinking of things like out of the box, like maybe making a drone co-op. And if anyone's going to take that, I have a copyright on it as of now. I was looking at eBay today. I was looking at drone prices just on eBay, and some of them were like $4,800 for a quadcopter. And that's a large sum of money for our farmers, and what are they going to get from it? You know, and so right. it's it's definitely, you have to do a serious cost-benefit analysis for these people and show that the benefits will outweigh what they're going to spend.
And the fifth key is to, this is interesting because this is kind of a different sort of a thing, and this maybe hits closer to home, at least on first blush, and that is use the power and voice of farmers to create pressure for FAA rules that are timely and make sense. This kind of remains the most significant roadblock. And, I mean, that's an item that clearly we see in areas other than just in agriculture.
Oh, absolutely. But aerial agriculture or ag flying and all that other has challenges of its own, and the FAA is trying to integrate things into the airspace. But agriculture is kind of a niche market, so they do need to work to develop reasonable and realistic rules to fly drones to support agriculture that may be different than your average run-of-the-mill integrating into the airspace or using them for observing fires, etc., some of the other functions we've talked about. It's got to be a three-way partnership: the FAA, the drone manufacturers, and the farmers themselves.
Now, the reason we bring all this up is not just specifically to instruct those of you who are considering agricultural applications, but just in general, because all of these things, I think, apply more broadly in because of the state of the of this market. So what I mean by that is that we're in our infancy, and while we're trying to approach markets other than just agriculture, there are many, many, many markets, but the concepts that have come out in this discussion are applicable to many of them. You have to know your customer. You don't make assumptions about what they want. Respect the knowledge that they have and integrate that with the product and the service that you're trying to provide. You know, all these things. Working, you know, leveraging the organizations, the market to help the FAA get to a good place with regard to rules and regulations. All these things apply very broadly, I think. The companies that pay attention to these kinds of things are the companies that are more likely to succeed in this market.
Even though they've changed the words, but every one of these things is listen, 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 listen. So, yeah, right. And that's just, that's always good customer service. It also makes us podcasters really happy.
Yes, oh, sure.
But since we were out in farm, we're talking about farm country, should we talk about the University of Nebraska and the Cornhuskers helping develop water sampling drones?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. The department, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and that's awarded a almost $1 million grant to University of Nebraska at Lincoln for a three-year project titled Co-Aerial Ecologist, Robot Water Sampling and Sensing in the Wild. And this is a part of the National Robotics Institute. Now, this is interesting. Sampling water, okay, that maybe isn't something that jumps out at you, but David, this is something that has some great applications.
And sampling water, it's interesting. We keep going to fire bombers and fires, but it's making a drone use the same technology as some of the water scoopers that are used to, like the Canadair firefighter that goes and flies along the water and drops a scoop down and then takes it over the fire and dumps it. Well, this, in this case, this is using a small Aztec ASC-TEC Firefly copter that can take 20 milliliters of water samples, but can only fly for a 20-minute duration. So you fly it out in the middle of the lake, scoop up 20 milliliter water samples, and fly it back so you can test the water quality. They're looking for something that's got a lot longer and more range, and water sampling is one of those vital things worldwide that keeping people's waters healthy is vitally important, especially after things like natural disasters like we've had in Denver this week here in the States. They've had a couple of dams break, and they've had severe flooding that has caused sewers to back up into the water supply. So you would want to quickly sample the water to see if it's healthy and potable for drinking.
That's right. And the method that would currently be used would be to ship some people, some equipment, you know, get it out to the site that may be difficult to get to in some cases and takes a lot of time. And David, as you mentioned, that sometimes the sampling requirement has got a time-sensitive component to it. You want to get out there and get it. So sending a little drone out there is sort of a perfect solution if you can figure out some of the issues associated with doing that. So they're using this Firefly, as you mentioned, David, which is
a hexacopter,
which is a hexacopter, right? It's got 6 8-inch propellers. And the Firefly is kind of interesting because it's sort of designed with autonomous flight experiments in mind. Now, they've modified the Firefly. It's got a hose that comes down from it that goes into the water, and the water's pumped up for the sample into some of these vials. And they've demonstrated this. There's some video. We'll put a link in the show notes. But there's a video of this. They've done it in the lab, and they've done it outside, sort of in a pool, and sort of proven the concept. But they want to, as David mentioned, increase the flight time. They also want to make these a bit more autonomous than they are now. And this is taking place in the Nebraska Intelligent Mobile Unmanned Systems Lab, which sort of turns into NIMBUS if you take the acronym.
The other important part that the long-term goal, and this is really kind of amazing, is you have these little water skimmers going out over the water and picking up the sample, but then on board, kind of like the rover on Mars, doing the analysis and just reporting the data back to the home base, which is the long-term goal of this project, which is just kind of amazingly awesome.
The NIMBUS lab, when you look at their website, they say that they're currently looking for some undergraduates and graduate students to become involved and to work on some of these ongoing projects. So if if you're of the college age and are considering this as a profession or looking for a way to get deeper into this, that may be a way to do it. Their website is nimbus.unl.edu. And this lab is funded partly from grants from the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, also the NSF, the National Science Foundation, and there's also some UNL support.
So, Max, you know what? What time is it?
Are we out of stories for this this week, David?
I think we're out of stories, and I think we're still desperately trying to keep this 30-minute time limit. So I think we're out of time. Oh, I'd like to say thanks for... We got our first iTunes feedback this week, which was 5 stars, which is really good. But if you're listening on iTunes, folks, again, so we can get the word out more so that to other listeners, definitely leave a review. So, and don't forget to stop by our website, theuavdigest.com, and follow us on Twitter at @UAVDigest and on Facebook at facebook.com/UAVDigest. And Max, I think you have to announce that we have a new pod feed.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with Stitcher.com, it's an interesting concept. It's a way to stream podcasts and other program material to your mobile device. So if you're on the go, if you're out and about, you can sign into Stitcher.com, find the UAV Digest, and you can stream us right to your mobile device. So that's another option for you. Of course, subscribing in iTunes or through your favorite podcatcher is another way to do that. If you do have a place where you go to subscribe to podcasts and you don't see the UAV Digest yet, please let us know. Send us an email. We're at feedback@theuavdigest.com, and we'll make sure to get into that directory.
Well, folks, we'll see you next week. This is David from Philly.
And this is Max from Hartford. Thanks for listening.